Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now that the hecklers and the pundits have had their say about the president's healthcare speech last night, it's time to get down to business. Item one, how are we going to pay for this thing? Also on the program today, Lehman Brothers, 1 year later. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by MassMutual, sponsor of Retirement Revolution, airing on PBS September 15th at 9 p.m. Eastern. Local listings at PBS.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Thursday. It is the 10th of September today. In his speech last night, the president laid out his plan for health care reform in public for the first time. He said the overhaul would cost $900 billion over the next 10 years and that millions of uninsured people would get coverage. He made some other bold claims, too, and this being the day after the big reveal, you know where this one's going to go. We asked Marketplace's Tamara Keith to check out a few of those claims.
President Obama pledged in no uncertain terms that his plan will cover the costs.
I will not sign it if it adds one dime to the deficit now or in the future, period.
None of the president's number crunchers were available, but the analysts I called weren't so sure about the deficit claim. John Shields is with the Lewin Group, a nonpartisan health consulting firm. He just analyzed the House health care bill. It's a lot like what the president wants.
Their bill is pretty much fully paid for in the first 10 years.
But
the following decade, we would increase the deficit by about $1 trillion for the program.
We've estimated that most of this plan can be paid for by finding savings within the existing healthcare system, a system that is currently full of waste and abuse.
Cato Institute fellow Michael Tanner says waste and abuse can be pretty slippery.
Yeah, we've been trying to find waste, fraud, and abuse since, Ronald Reagan, I think, came up with that phrase. Yet somehow it's still there.
The president also said his plan would tame health care inflation.
And if we are able to slow the growth of health care costs by just 0.1% each year, 0.1%, it will actually reduce the deficit by $4 trillion over the long term.
I headed straight to a health economist to tackle that one.
I've actually got a spreadsheet open right now.
That's Stephen Parenti from the University of Minnesota.
So once you actually apply the math to say 0.1 of essentially a percentage point of that change that you're talking about, and over maybe a 20 to 30 year period of time, you could actually net out $4 trillion.
Translation? The president's numbers check out if you wait 20 or 30 years. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
As long as we're talking big dollar amounts, here's one from the European Union. Today, the EU offered developing countries as much as $22 billion a year between now and 2020, in part to help them fight the effects of global warming, in part to persuade them to sign on to a big UN climate change treaty this December. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
The offer's not good enough. That's according to Tim Gore, EU policy advisor for Oxfam International. He's glad the EU made the first offer of aid, but he says those euros amount to a pittance.
The 2 billion would be ridiculous. The 15 billion is about half, or just under half, what we think is needed.
The money the EU is talking about translates into a maximum of $22 billion a year through 2020. Gore says when it comes to fighting climate change, the EU expects poorer nations to pay for most of that themselves. He says there's more money available to help countries adapt.
And it's desperately needed for things like investment in climate-resistant crops or early warning systems for flooding in areas which are particularly vulnerable to floods.
Gore says the current EU offer would fund early warning systems, but it wouldn't be enough to lift villages above floodplains before disaster strikes. That preserves livelihoods. Harvard economist Rob Stavin says don't expect other rich countries to help out much.
The political will is not going to be there, I could say for sure, from the United States, from the U.S. Congress, to be making massive direct transfers.
He says wealthier countries are happy to facilitate direct private investment, but poorer nations say if they're going to commit to a new climate change treaty, they want upfront cash from the countries they say caused the problem in the first place. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Being almost too good at what it does has proved to be a problem for Monsanto. The company said today it's looking at declining profits next year after 8 years of gains, mostly because sales of its blockbuster weed killer Roundup are dropping fast. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story.
In short, cheap generic herbicides are undercutting Monsanto's Roundup business. But it's more complicated than that, says analyst Mike Judd with Greenwich Consultants. A lot of things factor into herbicide sales, like the weather and how much commodities like corn and soybeans are selling for.
If a farmer is, you know, really in a great year, he's making a lot of money, he might prefer to have a brand-named, you know, herbicide versus a non-branded herbicide, a generic.
This year, farmer profits are down, unlike the last 2 years when farmers were raking it in and buying gallon after gallon of Roundup.
Basically, unsustainable profits for Monsanto over the last 2 years are coming to an end.
Or at least that's the view of an analyst with a sell rating on Monsanto. Analyst Charlie Rentschler with Wall Street Access has a buy rating on the stock. He says Roundup has served its purpose for Monsanto.
This was the business that really produce the cash flow to fund hundreds of millions of dollars per year of R&D in seeds and traits.
And that area, genetically modified products, is where Rentschler sees Monsanto's future.
This company yearns to be a strictly a biological company and not a, you know, combination biological chemical company.
That seems to be where Monsanto's chief financial officer thinks the money is. In a conference call this morning, he said he expects the world's demand for food to double by 2030, while the land available to farmers will shrink. He called that an opportunity for Monsanto. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, opportunity all over the place. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was something of a milestone today from UNICEF. The United Nations Children's Agency said the number of children dying before their fifth birthdays has fallen below 9 million a year for the first time on record. UNICEF credits donations from big groups and governments all over the world with helping to prevent hunger and illness. But it said small donations played a big role, too. And Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports that role is getting even bigger.
Over the past two decades, the mortality rate for young children has dropped by more than a quarter. That's mostly from lives saved in Africa and Asia. UNICEF's executive director, Anne Veneman, says a lot of the credit for this drop goes to small gifts, like the ones volunteers collect on Halloween.
I think sometimes people say, well, I wonder if I give money, does it really make a difference? And I think what the numbers show is this does make a difference. It saves children's lives.
Veneman says saving those lives isn't expensive. Vaccinations cost a few dollars. Supplying a bed net to prevent one of the biggest killers, malaria, costs $10. So a little money can make a big difference. Girl Scout Troop 895 in Barrington, Illinois, raised $150 to buy mosquito nets.
That was about one-third of our cookie money.
Troop leader Andrea Heffernan says her scouts donate every year.
Boy, they really felt like they were actually hands-on, doing something, which young children don't always get the chance to do.
And those Thin Mints can really add up, especially at a tough time for charities, says Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy.
The very wealthiest donors are cutting back in a very dramatic way, so that's why it's very important for charities to be focusing on people who give much smaller sums.
Palmer says charities are seeing declines of around 10% in giving this year, but many are also reporting a jump in the number of people who are contributing. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
NFL season starts tonight, the Tennessee Titans at Pittsburgh. As is par for the course in professional sports, there have been a bunch of coaching changes from last football season to this. There are 11 new head coaches in the league this year. Commentator and sports writer John Wertheim often has to report on those hirings and firings, but the state of the economy has him thinking he ought to be a little less cavalier about the livelihoods of others.
During a recent late-night drive, I caught a sports handicapper speaking with great certitude about the upcoming NFL season. Take it to the bank. The Steelers will repeat as Super Bowl champs, the Lions will win at least one game, and Dick Geron of the Buffalo Bills will be the first coach fired. Yes, there is an exchange where bettors can wager when a coach will lose his job. I suppose it shouldn't surprise me. You'd be hard-pressed to find an occupation with more rapid turnover than professional sports coach. During last year's NBA season, Oklahoma City's bench boss, P.J. Carlissimo, lasted all of 13 games before being given a pink slip. Three major league managers have already been fired in baseball this season. As a member of the sports media, I've lost count of the number of times I have, casually and cavalierly, called for a coach to be fired, axed, or, more euphemistically, relieved of his duties. Fans do likewise, going so far as to start websites devoted to the firing of an unpopular coach. It's like watching rodeo. You know the coaches will get ejected eventually. It's just a question of how long the ride lasts. Yet lately, at a time when national unemployment hovers around 10%, I'm having a hard time lobbying for anyone to get canned. Who among us hasn't seen the devastating effects of losing a job? Sure, pro coaches, whose annual salaries range from $1 million to $5 million, can handle the financial impact of job loss better than most. But there are other costs. There's the blow to the identity and sense of self. There's the effect on family dynamics. Even when another position comes open, it often entails relocation, selling a home at a loss, uprooting kids. There will always be turnover in competitive industries. And professional sports, where success and failure is measured unambiguously in wins and losses, they're as competitive as they come. Which means that coaches will remain vulnerable to job loss. You can't fire the players, the saying goes. Dick Geron may well not last the season in Buffalo. But shouldn't he have to do something worse than lose a few football games before we request that he join the growing legions of the unemployed?
John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. His most recent book is called Strokes of Genius. Share your thoughts with us. Our website is marketplace.org. There's a link up in the top right corner of that page that says Contact. Coming up, losing faith in the financial system.
It was like somebody just came and knocked all those dominoes, which would be our little people like us, out from under there. And then everybody crashed because we're the fiber, and then we were gone.
Lehman Brothers, a year after the fall. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 80 points today, 0.8%, closed at 96.27. The Nasdaq climbed 23 points, 1.1%. Ended the day at 2,084. The S&P 500 was up 10 points, 1%, finished at 1,044. Procter & Gamble boosted investors' hopes with a healthy sales forecast. The consumer goods giant rose 4.25% today. Airlines soared. United flew up 17%. Delta and American each climbed more than 10%. Continental added nearly 7% today. Yahoo clicked up 4.5%. The website's traffic is growing faster than overall internet growth, we learned. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 3.35%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Payroll Association, thanking payroll professionals during National Payroll Week, September 7th through the 11th. More at nationalpayrollweek.com. And by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's going on Friday. Events in Washington and New York mark the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary September survey of consumer sentiment. And a national group that organizes day laborers continues a 5-day convention in Silver Spring, Maryland. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you take a look around Wall Street today, it doesn't seem all that different from a year ago. Bankers and traders in the stock and bond market still dominate the lower end of Manhattan. Capitalism, fundamentally, still works. But last fall, incredible things happened. The government spent hundreds of billions of dollars bailing out the financial industry. But even though Washington had rescued Bear Stearns and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a year ago this coming Tuesday, it drew the line at Lehman Brothers. How Lehman went broke was and is a big and important story. Why it happened is more important.
At the end of the day, finance is all about faith. Money does not exist unless you believe in it. Otherwise, it's just a bit of paper.
Gillian Tett covered the credit crisis for the Financial Times. She turned that work into a book called Fool's Gold, about the idea that as strong and as secure as our financial system appears, it's really only as safe as our belief in it. For years, most of us did believe, until last fall, when we couldn't anymore. Millicent Hill, Mama Hill to the kids and almost everybody else, runs an after-school program out of her house in South Los Angeles. She's a small woman, but she's a commanding presence. She sits in the middle of a room crowded with books and school papers, greeting each of the kids as they come in.
Hi, Mama Hill.
Most afternoons, you can find a child or 10 working on their lessons spread out all over that house.
This is their house, and this is my bedroom right there. That's all I have. I don't have any other place to live.
Mama is serious about her kids. That's how the trouble started. 4 years ago, the city of Los Angeles cut her program out of the budget. So she did the only thing she could think of. She looked into a home equity loan to keep the program alive.
The advertisement said 4.2 interest rate, easy funding, 2-week funding, call us.
So she called. Kids figure pretty big in John Trin's life now, too. College kids. Trin left Wall Street this past June. At the end, he was running mergers and acquisitions for J.P. Morgan Chase, an interesting place to be last year about this time. Now he's out of banker's pinstripes and into khakis and a button-down, teaching at the business school at Lehigh University.
I'll be teaching an introduction to business, class one section, and then an upper-level finance elective in M&A. Which is what I practiced for 20 years on Wall Street.
About the same time that Mama Hill was taking out that home equity loan, Trin was watching Wall Street do its version of the same thing. Bankers were taking on more and more risk, bundling and selling off mortgages like Mama Hill's. Although Trin couldn't really figure out how those deals made any sense.
When you go back and look in the 2006-2007 time period and think about the large number of mortgage transactions that took place, and specifically subprime mortgage companies that were bought and sold predominantly by Wall Street firms, you couldn't understand where the valuations were coming from.
Trin and a lot of other people figured the bankers making those deals knew what they were doing. By the end of 2006, though, there were signs of trouble down deep in the mortgage industry, down where homeowners couldn't make their payments anymore. For Mama Hill, the interest rate on her loan had more than doubled. So she made another call.
I called them back. Maybe it was about 3 weeks because they said they were going to call me. They didn't call me. I called them back, and the number was disconnected. That's number one. I said, uh-oh.
That got her worried, a little suspicious maybe. But she still had faith everything was going to work out. Her loan was eventually sold to New Century Financial, at the time the biggest subprime lender in the country. In April of 2007, though, New Century went into Chapter 11, a passing noted by John Trinh in the thick of it at J.P. Morgan.
New Century, to me, that was the light switch in terms of, okay, things are not good in the system.
After New Century went bankrupt, Mama Hill's mortgage changed hands two more times. She barely knew who to pay.
Suddenly, Avila Mortgage had me, and I got a phone call from a Mr. James White, and he said, you know you're 6 months in arrears on your loan, and we're going to put your house up for sale.
What happened to Mama Hill was happening to people all over the country. Families were losing their homes. The number of foreclosures was going up. And yet, people weren't really paying attention. The Dow was still over 12,000. And everybody, even Ben Bernanke, thought the problems were only in real estate anyway. Until the Federal Reserve had to help rescue Bear Stearns. J.P. Morgan bought Bear at a fire sale price with some help from the Fed. And John Trinh was in the room when it happened.
Honestly, at that point, I didn't believe, and I think anybody who tells you that they did predict what was going to happen over the next, 6 months really was full of it. No idea that that was going to take place.
But it did happen. Lehman collapsed. AIG, Washington Mutual, Merrill Lynch, the list goes on. All of them got into trouble. And it caught almost everybody unaware. Everybody who for years had had a deep but basically irrational belief in the financial system. A belief that house prices and stocks and retirement accounts would keep going up. That a 25% annual gain in the value of your home was normal. Columbia University psychologist Elke Weber specializes in financial decision-making. What's going on inside our minds when we think about money?
Even experts are very much driven by their emotions and by sort of recent experience. And if investors who in their 30s or even 20s have never seen times when markets do tank, it's somewhat human nature to just assume that these trends will continue. It's not rational, but it's understandable.
We're so comfortable, we have no reason not to believe. Think about it. We haven't had anything too devastating within the few years to make us not believe it, that it would work out okay.
A lot of people who worked on Wall Street trading those mortgage-backed securities felt just as comfortable as Mama Hill did. Most of them had never seen a real bear market, much less an outright collapse. So they had no reason to believe everything wouldn't turn out all right. And even when the cracks did start to show, author Gillian Tett points out that their belief only became stronger because their jobs depended on it.
If you are a salesman working at a bank, every single instinct you have is to try and convince people that the future will be bright. You have to be optimistic for a living.
Optimistic, not just for a living, says Elke Weber, but for survival.
Too much worry can be dysfunctional. And so I think there's something quite adaptive about being too confident and sometimes overconfident in the success of our ventures.
Confident is good. Blind faith is bad. And that, in very large measure, is what got us to Bear Stearns and then Lehman Brothers. Once we realized what a house of cards we had built, we all wanted out in a hurry. At the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, economist Luigi Zingales runs a survey. It's called the Financial Trust Index. It's a measurement of how much faith we have in the financial system.
Clearly, banks are fragile institutions because they rely heavily on the trust of the public. We know, and I think that even the large public know if they've seen the It's a Wonderful Life, that if everybody ran on a bank, the bank cannot pay back everybody at the same time.
Even though most of us have federal deposit insurance, after Lehman, we just didn't trust it anymore. People actually pulled their money out of banks and stuffed the cash under their mattresses. Our retirement savings were cut in half. We didn't trust banks, Congress, the president, or the bailouts. We didn't trust anything. For Mama Hill, what had happened was pretty simple.
It was like somebody just came and knocked all those dominoes, which would be on little people like us, out from under there. And then everybody crashed because we're the fiber. And then we were gone.
Luigi Zingales did another survey a couple of months ago. Faith in the financial system is rising again.
The banking sector is a crucial engine of our system.
Provided we keep our eyes open.
When you invest in a bond or when you invest in the stock market, you are taking some risk. And or when investing in a house, for what matters. And you should be well aware that prices can go up or can go down.
And you have to believe that the whole financial system is going to work. Julian Tett from the Financial Times.
To rebuild trust in finance, you need to start rebuilding a sense that consumers of finance know what they're getting and can believe in both the products and the people peddling those products. That will require demonstration that some of the financiers actually understood what went wrong last time and are trying to put things right now.
John Trinh gets that. And if his students in that introduction to business class he's teaching this semester want to work on Wall Street, he'll help them get there. But he hopes things will be different by the time they do.
Shame on us as a country if we don't walk out of this with a 21st century infrastructure to manage the financial institutions going forward. And to me, if we walk away with that, then as painful as this was, it would have been worth it.
Mama Hill eventually got her house back, in a way. Two members of a local church bought that house. She rents it now. And even though her faith in banks and banking is pretty much gone, she knows she's going to jump back in eventually.
I'm really learning a lot of things about the finances. I'm learning how to manipulate it, because that has to be done. You know that. We have to manipulate it. I'm learning all the terms. So I want to do some things. I want to do some corporate things. I need to have some businesses to start in the community so the children can have jobs. So I'm going to have to be a business lady. I'm going to have to get back into the, quote, financial system.
That's a knowing laugh from a 69-year-old woman who's figured out the answer to the question a lot of us probably have after the fear and the losses of last fall. Should we get back into the financial system? Should we start trusting it again? We will, if only because we have to. Because otherwise, a dollar really is just a piece of paper.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, one last thought about the passing of Lehman Brothers. A year ago today was perhaps the last quiet moment before the chaos of late September and early October of 2008. Lehman reported a $3.9 billion quarterly loss that day. Its share price fell 45%. By the time the month was out, Merrill Lynch and Washington Mutual were gone. AIG had gotten an $85 billion bailout, which proved to be only a down payment. The Federal Reserve had begun lending money to almost any institution that needed it. And then on October 3rd, TARP, the $700 billion bank bailout, passed the House of Representatives on its second try. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 80 points, 8-tenths percent. The NASDAQ added 23 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 gained 10 points, 9-tenths percent. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Our Lehman Brothers special was produced by Megan Larson with Caitlin Carroll and Jolie Myers. For much more on Built on Belief, our series marking a year after Lehman's fall, check our website. It's marketplace.org. There's lots of good stuff there. Coming up next time on the broadcast, another anniversary, 8 years after September 11th.
I think it is a New York state of mind. I think memories have faded over time, but I don't think it takes much for people to jump.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.